of our executive producers for all of season 5. Before working on The Office, Paul had created the critically acclaimed single-camera comedy series Freaks and Geeks, which relied heavily on the same cringy, grounded comedy we were doing on The Office. Paul was instrumental in helping us find our way in those early seasons of the show. One of my favorite things about Paul is that he wears a suit and tie to work every day. This is unusual. Most directors and crew members dress in jeans or cargo pants. Maybe they wear a blazer, but never a tie. Paul told us his mom bought him his first three-piece suit when he was 8 years old. He loved it so much he wore it constantly, and so began his passion for suits. He even wore a suit while performing stand-up comedy in his 20s. Now he wears them every single day. He has a variety of vintage suits with vests and pocket squares and the coolest tie collection in the world. As a tribute to Paul when he was directing, our crew would all wear ties on Fridays. They called it Paul Feig Day. It was so fun.
The plot of our first Halloween episode is simple. Michael is told that he must fire someone during the month of October due to cutbacks at Dunder Mifflin. In true Michael fashion, he waits until the very last day of the month, i.e., Halloween. Greg Daniels told us that he'd always wanted to examine firing someone from the point of view of the boss, not the employee. He said you always see stories of the people being fired, but rarely stories about the person having to do the firing. One of our writers, Larry Wilmore, pitched the idea that the firing should happen on Halloween when everyone is dressed in costumes and excited for an office party. It makes the whole thing all the more uncomfortable to watch.
But there was one problem with this plot. To film this episode, Greg would have to fire a cast member. I can't imagine how this must have weighed on him, because Greg is such a kind-hearted human being. He didn't want to fire any of the core cast, even though this was before Booze Cruise, when most of the supporting characters were still only under weekly contracts. He also didn't want to hire someone new, throw them into the mix, and then cut them. He said it felt like cheating and wouldn't do justice to the plot. He had to fire someone we'd seen on the show already.
We had two regular background actors at that time, Creed Bratton and Devin Abner. Both had appeared in the mix of some conference room scenes or crossing behind someone as they did a talking head, but neither had spoken any lines. But since they'd been established in the world of The Office, they were employees of Dunder Mifflin. This meant they were up for firing. So now Greg was faced with a dilemma. Which one to fire? Greg and Michael had the same decision to make. Greg took both actors aside and found out that Devin was about to leave to do an off-Broadway play in New York. This made Greg's decision easier. Devin's character would be fired, and Creed would go from being a non-speaking background actor on our show to having a 5-page scene with Steve Carell. The scene was such a huge hit with fans, they lit up the internet message boards, and the writers began to write more for Creed. Creed eventually became a series regular, all because Greg needed someone to fire.
In addition to being the episode that cemented Creed's place in The Office family, it was also the first time since our pilot that the creators of the original British version of The Office, Stephen Merchant and Ricky Gervais, visited our set. They spent almost a full day with us that week. We were all geeking out, and of course I asked for a photo with them. And I love this photo. I'm the only person dressed in a costume. You can only sort of see John's 3-hole punches on his shirt. I mean, when I look at this photo, I like to imagine that I was doing a play about a cat, and this was a backstage picture taken when my close friends, including Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant, came to the theater to see me perform.
We were all so nervous about the visit. I mean, Ricky and Stephen are the comedy geniuses who had created the BBC version of The Office. They were why we all had a job. I'll never forget meeting them for the first time. I was walking through the lunch area, and I saw Ricky and Stephen finishing their meals. Our producers introduced me to them and then said, "Ricky's actually going back to the video monitors now because he's going to watch everything we are filming from lunch on to the end of the day. Angela, your talking head is first up." I think I vomited a little in my mouth before forcing a smile and saying, "Oh, fantastic." Ricky smiled back and answered, "Don't worry, I don't tisk too loudly," and he waved his finger back and forth at me. I nervous laughed, ha ha ha, while he cackled and patted me on the shoulder. I felt like I had passed some type of comedy club initiation. Years later, I found out we shared the same birthday, and we had a Twitter moment. I am pretty sure this means we're best friends now.
For as much fun as we had shooting the Halloween episodes, we made sure that the actual holiday was just as much fun, if not more so. Every year during the actual Halloween week, our crew would dress up and we'd have a costume parade during lunch. One year, the crew got together and dressed as our characters from the show. That was hilarious. They got all the details just right. When my son was 1 year old, I thought it would be cute to dress him as a Wimbledon tennis player for Halloween. My husband Lee is a huge tennis fan. We had gone to Wimbledon when we were engaged, and in a gift shop, we found a tiny white Wimbledon shirt for toddlers. I snatched it up and saved it. Since the players wear all white, it was an easy costume to assemble. I bought white shorts, little white shoes, and a hat. When Phil Shea, the head of the props department, heard me talking with Angela about Weston's costume, he arranged for a tiny, perfectly proportioned tennis racket and bag to be made. I'm not talking a plastic toy racket. I mean an actual metal tennis racket, just miniature. It was literally the cutest thing on the planet, and it made the outfit. Even though Weston could not officially compete in the crew awards, we marched in the parade just to show off Phil's work.
Halloween was a particularly fun week for kids on set. Many of our crew members would bring their families by for visits during Halloween week. My daughter Isabel was always so excited to see everyone's costume, although sometimes when she saw Mommy in costume, it would take her a moment to adjust. She loved me as a penguin, but her least favorite Angela Martin costume was Nancy Reagan. She didn't understand why her mom suddenly had short brown hair. Isabel would point at the wig and say, "Mama, no." I didn't mind the wig. I thought it was kind of fun. But I was not a fan of the very hot, very itchy suit. So at lunch, I would walk around as half Nancy, half Angela to cool off.
Our work days were long on the office. We averaged about 12 hours a day, usually something like 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. But that was nothing compared to most television shows. I know a lot of productions that often work until Fratterday, a nickname for working until 2 or 3 a.m. every Friday night. Once in a while, we'd go as late as 7:30 p.m. or have a night shoot, but not often, and never on Halloween. On Halloween, we always finished early. Looking back, I'm not sure if this was good luck or great planning, but I don't remember a single Halloween in 9 years where we worked late. It was amazing because many members of the cast and crew had families with young children, and they could be home in time to celebrate.
In fact, every year, our camera operator Matt Sohn and his wife Melissa would throw a party at their house after work for the entire office group and our families. Unlike me, they lived in a great neighborhood for trick-or-treating. We'd show up at their place for food and crafts with our kids and then canvass the neighborhood for candy. Even cast members without kids were welcome. BJ Novak made it part of his Halloween tradition every year to help hand out candy at Matt's house. It was that much fun.
The office was very unique. This reality hit me very hard the first year I was working on a new show after The Office, splitting up together. Halloween was on a Tuesday that year. The Friday before, the producers came to me and said, "Jenna, we've run late this week. We had to drop a couple of scenes, and the only day we can rent a crane in order to get that missed shot is Tuesday next week. We're going to have to tack it on to the end of the day. You'll probably be done around 8 p.m. My kids were 3 and 6 at the time. They were in bed before 8 o'clock. I had just been told I would completely miss Halloween. Missing things is part of being a working parent. I knew that when I started my career. Television hours can be long and unpredictable, and part of being a working actor means turning over your schedule to the needs of the production. But if I'm being honest, missing moments with my kids was harder on me than I expected. The missed bedtimes and school concerts and leaving before my kids woke up in the mornings and FaceTiming them for dinner was taking a toll. And at that moment, finding out I'd be missing Halloween just crushed me. I called Angela crying. I knew my bestie would understand how my mom heart was breaking.
Missing any special occasion with your kids is very hard. As working parents, this is something we all have to deal with at some point, but it is never easy. I could hear the sadness in Jenna's voice, and it broke my heart. I shared with my kids that Jenna might have to miss Halloween with her family, and they felt just like I did. "No, that can't happen," they all exclaimed. I had an idea of how we could help, and they were eager to pitch in to make my plan happen.
On Sunday morning, 2 days before Halloween, my phone rang. It was Angela. "What are you doing tonight at 5 o'clock?" "Nothing," I replied. "Well, I know what you're doing. Dress up your kids in their costumes and get to my house. I've talked to a couple of neighbors on my street, and I bought Halloween candy for them to give to your kids. We're going trick-or-treating. You will not miss Halloween on my watch." I started sobbing. And then I did what I was told. Angela was not messing around. I dressed up my kids in their costumes and drove to her neighborhood at 5 p.m. Angela and her family were waiting for us. We walked around collecting candy from her sweet neighbors, and then we went back to her house and roasted s'mores in the backyard. It was perfect. I know it all might sound silly in the grand scheme of things that are important in life, but Angela knew that Halloween with my 3- and 6-year-old was significant to me, that my mom heart needed it. Along with her community of neighbors, she created a special memory for us, one that we'll never forget. I've shared so many Halloweens with her, but that one is the most special of all.
Looking at the pictures of that evening brings happy tears to my eyes. Tears for my best friend, who is such an amazing mom and values family over everything. Tears because my children were so excited to help. And tears for the kindness of my neighbors, who instantly said yes to make it all happen.
Christmas. If you thought Halloween was big at Dunder Mifflin, wait until we tell you about Christmas. Every inch of our set would be covered with Christmas decorations, and I mean every inch. Get ready for holiday garland around your computer screen and no less than 2 dozen poinsettia. Angela and I would joke about where Dunder Mifflin got its budget for holiday celebrations. Did Michael pay out of pocket? Because surely corporate would never allocate so much funding for decorations. And just like Halloween, we loved seeing everyone dressed up in holiday attire while shooting these episodes.
While all the Office Christmas episodes are incredible, the first one, Christmas Party, inspired some amazing off-camera memories and traditions. This episode was directed by Charles McDougall. I'm certain I speak for all the actors when I say Charles will always hold a special place in our hearts. He directed 8 episodes of The Office, and Christmas Party was his first. Imagine meeting a quiet British man in a gray sport coat, soft-spoken, and serious about his work. Then imagine that same man screaming, "Action!" at the top of his lungs, as if he were rolling on the Roman chariot race in Ben-Hur, rather than on a few people pretending to do office work. That was Charles. This duality was so charming, and it cracked us up. Written by Mike Schur, this episode had it all. A tree that was too big, a Secret Santa gift exchange that turned into a cruel Yankee swap, a teapot, a poster of babies playing jazz, a sad oven mitt, and a very pissed off Angela Martin. Mike Schur told me once that he loved seeing my character trying to keep it together, getting more and more stressed out until she finally unraveled. Well, this episode delivered that in spades for Angela. I actually got a headache from all of the frowning and glaring I had to do in that episode. Despite the throbbing head, this episode was some of the most fun I ever had on set. We broke into laughter a lot, especially during the Yankee Swap gift exchange. Charles McDougall had to keep reminding me that I had to be angry. He would start off each take with, "Okay, everyone happy, Angela pissed, and action!"
It is during this first Christmas episode that Michael famously turns the Secret Santa gift exchange into a Yankee Swap. All the gifts that were purchased or made with a certain person in mind are suddenly shuffled around, and everyone tries to get their hands on the iPod Michael bought for Ryan. Feelings get hurt. People get angry. Phyllis is especially gutted when Michael rejects and then continues to insult the oven mitt she knitted for him. I remember it was a challenging shoot day for Phyllis. Most of the cast was cracking up and goofing around between takes, but in order to stay in character, Phyllis had to go off to the side by herself. She basically spent the entire day crying alone. When the scene was finally over, I gave her a big hug. But even Phyllis had to laugh when we first saw Angela Martin's gift from Toby, the poster of two babies playing brass instruments. We had read about this moment in the script, but none of us were truly prepared for what it would look like in real life. It took us about 10 minutes to pull ourselves together and continue shooting. One of my personal favorite behind-the-scenes moments was when we decided to see if Angela could fit inside one of the Yankee Swap gift bags. She could.
Another special aspect of this episode was the snow. The crew hired a company called, get this, Snow Business, to turn Dunder Mifflin's parking lot into a winter wonderland. We never get snow in Los Angeles, so even fake snow felt magical. Some fun facts about fake snow. First, the snow on the ground is basically real snow. Snow Business brought in a machine that looks like a combination of a wood chipper and something you might see Wile E. Coyote trying to build to catch the Roadrunner. That machine freezes water into little particles and blows it out a giant tube, in this case all over the Dunder Mifflin parking lot. The snow that falls from the sky, or in our case, from a man on the roof, is not real. You get three choices for the falling snow: cornstarch, plastic, or soap. Greg watched a demonstration of all three and picked soap, as he thought it looked the most realistic. As my character was having a screaming meltdown in the parking lot, some of it fell into my mouth, and I can confirm, they definitely used soap.
The next night, the entire cast had to shoot a very simple scene of us all walking to our cars through the snowy parking lot. It was footage without any dialogue that would play underneath a Michael talking head. It meant staying late, waiting for nightfall. We were punchy and wired like a bunch of kids up past their bedtime. I remember walking into the parking lot that night, cars covered in snow, the moon high in the sky. It was enchanted. After we shot the scene a couple of times, Charles said, "One more and then I think we've got it. Action!" Near the end of that last take, one of the guys, probably John, picked up some snow and flung it at another one, probably Brian. And then it was on. We all started picking up snow and had a huge impromptu snowball fight. The cameras kept rolling and captured it all. I love when I watch that scene now because it's one of the moments when our real selves blurred with our characters. We were coworkers who loved one another, having a snowball fight after work. We just happened to also be making a television show in the process.
We had a lot of fun pretending to celebrate Christmas at Dunder Mifflin, but we also had a lot of fun actually celebrating the holiday. As with Halloween, we would shoot these holiday episodes long before Christmas, so when December finally came around, it was like we got a second celebration. From the moment you entered our soundstage, you were greeted with holiday cheer. I remember one year the hair and makeup department had a Christmas tree by their touch-up tables backstage, and right around the corner, our sound department had a tree as well. Peter and Vartan at Craft Services would decorate the snack table, and our last week of filming before our winter break, the crew would all dress in holiday garb. There was a lot of gift-giving, too. The cast would give the crew gifts, and the producers gave out gifts in green Dunder Mifflin holiday bags. One of my favorites was a cozy blue robe that I still wear to this day, even though my dog gnawed a hole in the right sleeve. As a cast, we gave one another gifts as well. Jenna made us all Christmas ornaments. Mine still hang on my tree each year, and I made everyone t-shirts inspired by Dwight quoting Billy Zane from Titanic. Kate gave us candles, and there were bottles of wine, fruit baskets, sweet treats, and handwritten cards. Everyone was so thoughtful.
I still exchange holiday cards with many of our cast and crew, and I look forward to decorating my home with their faces every year. As you can see, the cast and crew of The Office celebrated nearly a decade of milestones and holidays together. Creating your own holiday traditions when you live far away from your family of origin is a mighty task. My mom was one of five siblings. My dad has one brother. During my childhood, everyone lived in St. Louis, including my grandparents and great-grandparents. Holidays were filled with a series of visits to great aunts and grandparents and involved dozens of cousins and even more gifts. I haven't gone home for Christmas since my own children were born, but if I flew home to surprise everyone, I'd know exactly where to go at what time on what day without even asking. Every year the plans were the same, and I loved it. But once I became a parent, my husband and I wanted to create our own holiday traditions, and we wanted our kids to wake up to Santa in their own house. So, while we see lots of family throughout the year, we don't travel for the holidays. Now, Christmas is filled with friends who have become our surrogate family. In our version, Oscar is their crazy uncle, and Angela is their loving aunt. Her kids, Isabel, Jack, and Cade, are their cousins. Angela always hosts some sort of holiday potluck, and anyone who needs a family to be with during that time is invited. Because that's how Angela is, you guys. If you need a family, she's there. Her husband Josh has usually baked up some delicious sweets, and Creed brings his guitar. Every year is a little different depending on who attends, but it's always fantastic. My husband Lee and I host an ice skating party every Christmas Eve. We rent out the local ice rink for 2 hours. The rink is divided into two parts, one half for skating, the other for hockey. We bring hot chocolate, coffee, and donuts. We invite our kids' school friends and anyone else who needs a tradition at the holidays. Oscar and his family are always there. Angela is there, too. It means so much to us that we've created these yearly traditions together. And finally, no Christmas season would be the same without Angela's adults-only Yankee Swap Party.
That's right. Our Yankee Swap on the show was so much fun to shoot that I decided to turn it into a real yearly holiday party. It started out small. I decorated my front door with a festive wreath, put out a cheese plate, and invited a handful of friends. But with each passing year, the party grew. Coworkers, friends, family, and my neighbors now all stop by. I keep adding decorations to the house, and folks, we are inching toward Clark Griswold territory. I put up tons of Christmas lights, and there's a huge inflatable polar bear with an igloo and spinning penguins to greet everyone as they come inside. My house can no longer hold the crowd, so I started opening the back doors, and the party now spills out into the backyard. There's a taco truck, a huge dessert table, thanks to my husband, a makeshift bar, a fire pit, and we even hand out sparklers at the end of the night. I can't wait to see everyone and what gifts they will bring. On my invitation, I state that regifting tacky items is encouraged, and my guests do not disappoint. And if you plan on hosting a Yankee Swap, put Oscar Nunez at the top of your guest list. He really gets the crowd going, making up chants and taunts. One of his most catchy was, "Give him the hose! Give him the hose!" in regard to a garden hose that was an aggressively traded item. Things have gotten physical. I have had my hand swatted at by my normally shy, soft-spoken neighbor as I stole a Superman apron from him. And then there was the time that Jenna elbowed our friend Amy as she nabbed a coveted fake ponytail that had been traded 3 times. And I still have the creepy porcelain clown I won the first year I hosted this party. It felt right to keep it.
Angela's Yankee Swap parties are legendary. People come ready for fun. I find that practical gifts make the best offerings at the Yankee Swap. Small axe, new garden hose, electric bug zapper shaped like a tennis racket. We've brought all of these and people fought hard for them. Angela mentioned the fake ponytail extension was a prized gift 1 year. I'm proud to say I went home with that one and then smugly wore it to the party the following year. Back when we were shooting that first Christmas episode in 2005, I could never have imagined that this group of people would become my real-life holiday family and that I would still be celebrating the holidays with them 15 years later, or that I would battle Ed Helms for a miniature Egyptian sarcophagus that Zach Woods brought to Angela's Yankee Swap. But I did, and I won. As soon as the description on the box was read aloud, I knew I had to have it. The sarcophagus coffin and the mummy are not fixed to each other, and so, if you remove the mummy, the sarcophagus can function as a keepsake or jewelry box. I have it on my dresser, and inside are my snowman earrings, ready and waiting for the next holiday party.
Chapter 6. The Women of Dunder Mifflin.
The women of Dunder Mifflin are an outstanding bunch. There is the talent you see on screen, of course, but that's just the start.
We want to give you a more intimate look at our fantastic group of gals, because hot damn, they deserve it.
Let's be honest. When The Office started, it was a bit of a sausage fest. I was the only female cast member under regular contract. Mindy Kaling was the only female writer. Our casting director, Allison Jones, had been a huge influence on the shape of the show. But we only had one female executive producer, the incredible Terry Weinberg, and the only female department heads were in hair, makeup, and costumes. Angela, Phyllis, Kate, and Melora Hardin, who played Jan, rounded out the supporting cast. Sprinkle in a few women on the production staff, and there you have it. It's no wonder we became a tight-knit group. Since this is our book and we are in charge here, Angela and I would like to take up some space and talk a little bit about what made the women of Dunder Mifflin so awesome.
Let's start with our original costume designer, Carrie Bennett, who was with us for seasons 1 through 4 of The Office. Her role as one of the visionaries of our show is often left out of the narrative. This is a massive oversight, because so much of the look of our show has to do with Carrie. And I don't just mean the costumes. When Carrie was tasked with doing the costume design for our pilot episode, she launched into some detailed research. As she put it, "I'd never worked in an office, and I never assumed that I know what I'm talking about. I always try to go to the source and see something in real life." So she opened up a phone book and found a small local paper company located in Glendale, California, called them up, and asked if she could visit.
Carrie told us that when she took her tour of the little paper company, she realized that every character from The Office was working there. For example, there was an employee wearing a shirt with a photo of a howling wolf. She made a note, "Dwight, wolf shirt," because this felt like something he would wear outside of work. In addition to taking detailed wardrobe notes, she also took hundreds of photos of the space itself. Little gems like the inspiration posters on the walls, funny clippings posted on people's desks, a deer head in the warehouse. She assembled these photos into a slideshow, put it to music, and played it for Greg Daniels, director Ken Kwapis, and our original production designer, Donald Lee Harris. Not surprisingly, they flipped out and asked Carrie if she could arrange another tour. They took even more photos on the second visit, and then use them to inform their design of the office bullpen and warehouse sets.
During the fire in season 2, Carrie's attention to detail paid off again. In that episode, she needed to create wardrobe for the Scranton Fire Department. Every fire department in the country has a unique patch, and she wanted to get Scranton's right. She could have just done a general patch, but that wasn't good enough for Carrie. At that time, 2005, you couldn't find images on the internet as easily as you can today. So Carrie called the Chamber of Commerce in Scranton and connected with a woman named Mary, who offered to walk down to the fire station, take a photo of the patch, and send it to Carrie.
This started a relationship between our show and Mary at the Scranton Chamber of Commerce that really enhanced the look of the office. Mary organized a huge meet and greet for our prop master, Phil Shea, and local Scranton business owners. Phil went to Scranton, where they set him up with a booth in the Steamtown Mall. Hundreds of Scrantonites lined up to meet Phil and offer their special items in hopes that they'd be featured on the show. Magnets, stuffed animals, pizza boxes, flyers. It's why the set is covered in local treasures. And it was all set in motion by Carrie.
The pedigree of the women on our show was incredible. Take Kate Flannery, for example. Kate was a member of Second City's National Touring Company and an original member of the Annoyance Theater in Chicago. For over 20 years, Kate has been one of the stars of a hit comedy lounge act called The Lampshades with fellow improviser Scott Robinson. This woman has chops. She can sing, dance, act, and is an amazing improviser. Anyone who's seen her do a high kick into a deep lunging squat while belting out a song during a lampshade show knew she'd be fantastic on Dancing with the Stars. She can do it all. If you get a chance, go see one of Kate's shows with Jane Lynch and the Tony Guerrero Quintet, Two Lost Souls and A Swingin' Little Christmas. Both are fantastic. Of all the women on the show, I have known Kate the longest. She is a tried and true friend, there for you no matter what. We were on the phone the other day trying to figure out how long we've known each other. We think we are at 24 years as friends. Our timeline starts in our 20s as struggling actresses balancing odd jobs and auditioning. We were both trying to make rent and get on stage anytime we could. We spent countless hours together both on stage in various shows and backstage at the IOS Theater in West Hollywood. I have helped her zip into a red, bedazzled jumpsuit for the lampshades, and she's helped me put on wigs for sketch comedy shows. We have both bombed on stage and had nights where we felt like the queens of comedy. Imagine my delight when we got to live out our acting dreams together on The Office.
I don't think anyone was asked to do more stunts on our show than Kate. During her time on The Office, her character of Meredith was attacked by a bat and hit by a car. She set her hair on fire, flashed her coworkers several times, drank hand sanitizer, was forcibly dragged to rehab, and shaved her head, just to name a few. There were also several gags that ended up on the cutting room floor, like a scene in Back from Vacation, Season 3, when a series of shelves falls on Meredith as she's doing inventory in the warehouse. With only a few exceptions, Kate did all her own stunt work. The thing I admire most about Kate is her old-school approach to performing. She and Creed are similar in this way. They will do anything to entertain an audience. She gives 110% to every performance. It doesn't matter if it's a stunt or 8 hours of background work. She's all in. We used a stunt woman, Marie Fink, to double for Kate when her hair was on fire, but it was Kate who took several blasts of fire extinguisher foam to the face. And that's really Kate under a trash bag in the kitchen as Dwight tries to trap a bat on her head. That's really Kate on the hood of Michael's car. And yes, Pam really hits her in the face with a football. And while she didn't actually shave her head, the 4 hours Kate spent in makeup to achieve that look counts as a stunt in my book. Kate and I were often paired together for background work, but we didn't share a major storyline until the lice episode in Season 9. In this one, Pam unknowingly infects the office with lice. Meredith freaks out and ends up shaving her head to keep from getting them. But in the end, Pam and Meredith go out for beer and karaoke and bond over the difficulty of raising kids without help, as this happened while Jim was away in Philadelphia launching his business. Kate and I were excited when we got the script because we finally had a Pam-Meredith plotline. We had one whole shoot day all to ourselves, something that had never happened. We got to go on location and sing. It was one of my favorite days of shooting ever.
The other woman in the bullpen was none other than Phyllis Lappin Vance, winner of the 8th Annual Dundee Award for Busiest, Bushiest Beaver, and my party planning committee nemesis. Even though our characters were frenemies, in real life we were thrilled when we had scenes together. Our biggest challenge was getting through them without dissolving into laughter. Case in point, the scene in Launch Party, Season 4, where Phyllis nails me in the face with a pile of post-it notes. When we had scenes with a lot of dialogue together, we would meet in her trailer and rehearse our lines before we filmed. It was during this time that we became friends. I came to adore this woman. We both grew up going to church, and in those early days of the show, we would get together and pray. We would pray about whatever was weighing on our hearts, for our show and the cast and crew. I remember those moments so fondly.
I felt an instant connection with Phyllis because we are both from St. Louis. We bonded over our love of toasted raviolis and gooey butter cake, both St. Louis inventions, and of course, the St. Louis Cardinals. During our first season, the Cardinals were in the World Series against the Boston Red Sox. There were a ton of men in the cast and crew who had lived in Boston. John, BJ, Steve, Greg Daniels, Mike Schur, and several of them would gather in John Krasinski's trailer to watch the games. Meanwhile, Phyllis and I watched in my trailer. The Boston Red Sox swept the Cardinals 4-0 that year. It was brutal on set for us St. Louis gals. However, in 2011, the Cardinals won the World Series in an epic battle against the Texas Rangers. By this time, we'd added another St. Louis native, Ellie Kemper, to the cast. You can only imagine how excited we were when World Series MVP David Freese and Matt Holliday visited the set. The three of us were seriously giddy with excitement. As far as I know, no one from the Boston Red Sox ever visited. Take that, boys. While I wanted to do victory laps around the bullpen and really rub it in the boys' faces, Phyllis was happy to gloat quietly from her chair. In general, Phyllis is one of those people who listens more than she speaks, which is very different from how I operate. One day, while we were getting snacks during a break, I told her I really admired this quality. Phyllis smiled and said, "Sometimes I can be standing close to people and they don't notice I'm there." Then she leaned in and whispered, "I've heard a lot of stuff, Jenna. A lot." I laughed so hard at that. What does Phyllis know?
In our early days, it was mostly just the four of us gals on set. We bonded quickly and effortlessly. We laughed a lot. When we found out we'd been picked up for a second season, we decided to celebrate with a fancy brunch at the Ivy on Robertson Boulevard. This is the famous restaurant where all the Hollywood stars go to be seen. The paparazzi have a permanent spot on the sidewalk, and they snap photos of celebrities dining on the patio. By the way, if anyone tells you they didn't want to be photographed having lunch at the Ivy, they are lying. It's literally why you go. We had Jenna's agent make a reservation for a patio table. The agency even told the restaurant we were celebrating the pickup of The Office for a second season and that Jenna would be dining with her co-stars. We were so tickled, thinking this would get us some kind of fancy schmancy star treatment. When we arrived, the maitre d' took us to an inside table, all the way in the back of the restaurant, by the doors to the kitchen. Jenna piped up with, "I'm sorry, we requested a table on the patio." The maitre d' coldly replied, "That's reserved for VIPs." Our choice was clear. The table by the kitchen, or goodbye. We couldn't help but laugh. This wasn't exactly the schmancy treatment we had envisioned. We toasted with our mimosas to the tune of clanking dishes, busboys arguing, and a lovely breeze from the staff rushing past our table in and out of the kitchen.
The waitstaff was over the top snooty and dismissive of us that day. We wondered if this was part of their training, like the famous Chicago diner Ed DeBevick's, where the servers are purposely rude to you as part of the charm of the restaurant. My order came out wrong, and Angela was never served her iced tea. The whole experience was so incredibly cartoonish, we still laugh about it today. We were definitely reminded of our place in the Hollywood ecosystem. As we were leaving, we saw a gang of paparazzi rush past us down the sidewalk. They chased someone into a store and were taking photos through the window. Angela bravely pulled one of the photographers aside and asked who they were following. Jason Alexander. What happened next is perhaps one of my favorite Angela stories ever. Still a little stung by our Ivy experience, Angela was determined to salvage a star moment for us. She coyly said to the photographer, "Do you know who she is? She's Pam from The Office." Obviously, if you have to ask, they don't know. He looked at us blankly. Angela then motioned to the group. "We are the ladies of The Office." Still nothing. Angela pushed harder. "On NBC. The Office. On NBC. Finally, the guy's face lit up. "Are you serious?" But he didn't raise his camera. Instead, he reached into his pocket and produced a business card. He said, "Here's my card. If you ever want to tip me off on when celebrities will be out and about, I'll give you a finder's fee." And then he pushed us aside because Jason Alexander was getting into his car. It took us a minute until we all collectively realized that he thought we worked in an office at NBC. Oh my God, we died. It was so funny, I thought we were going to pee our pants. We asked the hostess to take our photo instead.
It's hard to believe, but the following year, we went back again to celebrate the pickup for the new season. I know, we are gluttons for punishment. Again, Jenna had her agent make the reservation. This time, I brought along a little cake that said Office Ladies Season 3 on it to celebrate. Unfortunately, Kate couldn't join us as she got hired for a gig at the last minute. The Ivy nearly denied our reservation because our entire party didn't show up. I thought telling them we were on a television show might help save our spot. So, once again, I proudly told the maitre d' we were on The Office, to which he replied, "Which office?" He wasn't having it. He told us we had 15 minutes for our party to be complete, or they would give our table away. There was a coffee bean on the corner, and I thought maybe we should just go there instead. But Jenna was determined. By this time, she had graduated to one of the big-time agencies in town, WME. We knew the Ivy wouldn't want to piss off WME, so Jenna mentioned maybe she should call her agent who had made the reservation. She had seen this trick in a movie. Well, it worked! They seated our incomplete party, and this time, we did indeed get a table on the patio.
We shared a lovely lunch on the patio. Angela got her iced tea. Things were going good. When it came time for dessert, Angela took out the cake she had brought. Within seconds, Snooty Waiter, who had clearly been trained on the same day as Snooty Maitre d', was next to our table telling us that no outside food was allowed in the restaurant. We had to put our cake back in the box. Fair enough. But we took a photo first and put up with the stink eye. After lunch, as we stood in line for the valet, a man and his date brushed right past us and took a spot at the front of the line. The paparazzi surrounded him, clicking away. They did not take our photo, of course. We didn't care. We had given up on ever getting our photo taken. But that's when I realized the person who had just butted in line was a big deal singer. I was a little starstruck. I tapped his shoulder and mumbled, hello. I literally love your voice. Excited to see what you do next. I am not exaggerating when I say that he looked at me like I was a turd. Well, by then, Angela had had enough. I mean, she was willing to forgive Big Deal Singer for butting in line, sort of, but no one is allowed to be a douchebag to her best friend. Guys, this fella is tall, over 6 foot. Angela is 5'1". But I tell you what, that gal stepped right up to that man and took him down with a look I can only describe as chilling. I think I saw him shudder. His whole posture changed when my girl stepped in, and he meekly shook my hand. The next year, we skipped the Ivy. We had learned our lesson by then. But I'm not going to lie, I'm a little tempted to go back now just to see what happens. At least us gals got some good stories out of the experiences.
While the main actresses on set every day were Jenna, Kate, Phyllis, and me, we also had Melora Hardin and Mindy Kaling join us from time to time. Melora Hardin played the role of Jan Levinson for 42 episodes of The Office. Jan is introduced in the pilot episode as the vice president of Dunder Mifflin. She works in the corporate offices in New York City and is often tasked with giving Michael bad news. In later seasons, Jan becomes Michael's love interest. Melora played her role beautifully. I used to love to watch her in a scene. She and Steve made a terrific acting team. If you want to see some of the best comedic acting ever, watch Melora Hardin in Dinner Party, Season 4. In 22 minutes, she plays out awkward moments full of jealousy, disdain, pride, absolute rage, and a deep sadness. It's not easy to slowly and comedically unravel while staying believable. Kids, study this performance. It really doesn't get much better.
Of all the women in our cast, Melora had the most professional acting experience when we started the show. She'd been acting since she was 6 years old. I fully geeked out when I found out she had been in 2 episodes of one of my favorite shows growing up, Little House on the Prairie. And she was originally cast as one of the lead actors in Back to the Future. The original Marty McFly was Eric Stoltz, and Melora was cast as Marty McFly's girlfriend, Jennifer. But when the studio decided to recast Eric Stoltz with Michael J. Fox, they said Melora was too tall to play Michael J. Fox's girlfriend, and they recast her too. Can you imagine? A 2-movie deal just gone. Melora was only 17 years old when this happened. That probably would have made me quit acting completely, but Melora soldiered on. She's a pro. On a personal note, she always felt like a big sister to me. She gave me advice about how to navigate many of the non-acting aspects of the business. By this, I'm referring to the information your agent might tell you, but that you really trust when it comes from a colleague. My favorite tip from Melora during 10-hour press junkets, which are most often done in hotels, ask the studio to book you a room so you can get a full hour to yourself and maybe a nap during lunch. It's one of those things you can have, but only if you know to ask. As a new actor, I was usually too shy to ask for anything when I started on The Office. All too often, women who self-advocate get labeled as difficult or divas. But the truth is that asking for a room is self-care, and it made me better equipped to make it through on junket days. It took some practice, but I slowly got used to asking for what I need. Melora set a good example in that regard. She was not afraid to advocate for herself or others. At the 2005 Emmy Awards, the press asked Steve, Rain, John, BJ, and me to pose for photos with the Emmy backstage. Melora piped in, "Hold up! We are all part of the cast!" And then she added herself and the rest of the actors to the photo.
Melora was the first working mom slash actress I ever met. She was also a very confident, hands-on mother. She would routinely come to set for wardrobe fittings with her baby strapped to her chest. So when I became pregnant, I asked her many questions about how she navigated set life as a new parent. Her tips were so helpful and included many things I hadn't even thought of. For example, she told me if I planned to breastfeed that I would need a mini fridge at work to store my milk during the day, and also a way to transport it home safely. It sounds obvious, but I hadn't thought about where I would store my milk at work, let alone how to get it home. I had a mini fridge in my trailer, but it didn't work. I'd never needed it before, so I hadn't cared. I asked the transportation guys if they could fix it, and I bought a little cooler for my car ride. Because of Melora, I was breastfeeding ready for my return to work. She also told me that since my daughter was going to be a Taurus and I was a Cancer, we would be very compatible. I didn't know much about astrology then, and still don't, but she explained that Taurus is an earth sign and Cancer is a water sign, so the two will always need each other. I was about 8 months pregnant at the time of this conversation, so I burst into tears. I just loved the sound of that. And also, hormones.
And then there was the amazing Mindy Kaling. Mindy split her time between the set and the writer's room at The Office. For a long time, Mindy was the only female writer on our show, the lone female voice. After her play, Matt and Ben, was acclaimed at the New York International Fringe Festival in 2002, she was granted 2 interviews for writing jobs in Hollywood. One of the shows was canceled while she sat in the waiting room. The other was with Greg Daniels for The Office. He hired her for what would be her first job writing for television. Mindy wrote many of my favorite episodes, The Dundies, The Injury, Niagara, and she made history writing Diwali, the first American television comedy series to depict that Hindu festival.
My first memory of Mindy is her smile. We were gathered for one of our first script readings, and Greg went around the room asking everyone to say their names as we were all still getting to know one another. Mindy was wearing a brightly colored sweater and sitting with the male writers. I was instantly drawn to her. She was chatty, and I like chatty. She seemed to know a lot about the most random aspects of pop culture. It was so entertaining. I just loved talking to her.
As far as The Office, I don't think any character went through a bigger change than Mindy's character of Kelly Kapoor. Kelly Kapoor starts off as a rather quiet and stiff customer service representative seated in the corner of the back annex. Her hair is up in a tight French twist, and she wears paisley blouses that button up to the neck. She is very serious and rarely smiles or laughs. But as you track her character over the course of the first 2 seasons, you'll notice a transformation. The hair starts to come down, the blouses change, and eventually she is seen smiling and jabbering away to Jim about her crush on Ryan, her love of Beyoncé, and the color pink, and also the singer pink. From there, she gets full hair extensions and starts a hilarious on-again, off-again romance with Ryan the temp. We asked Greg Daniels about the transformation of Kelly Kapoor. He told us it was due to a subtle but relentless campaign waged by Mindy in the writer's room behind the scenes. He said they finally just gave in and let Mindy write her own personality into the role of Kelly. Hanging out with Mindy is kind of like attending a 24-hour slumber party. Like Kelly, She loves fashion and she loves to talk. But unlike Kelly, she also loves to hear your stories. She loves your birthday as much as her own. Well, maybe not exactly as much, but close. She loves to send gifts. She chose the most expensive item on my baby registry, my breast pump. I had questioned if I should even include it on the registry, to be honest, and I was so touched that she had sent it. But the most impactful thing about working with Mindy, for me, was her unapologetic ambition. I'd met a lot of ambitious women in my life, but Mindy was different because she was not afraid to speak openly about her desire to be successful. Mindy and I had many conversations about what we hoped to accomplish in our careers. We have even asked each other questions like, "What net worth is your ultimate goal?" It was incredibly empowering to encounter another woman on the rise who would speak so frankly and strategically about what she wanted to achieve in her life. It empowered me. I am not at all surprised by all of Mindy's success after leaving the office. She's one of the smartest people I know.
While on the office, Mindy and I shared some heart-to-hearts in the stairwell outside of the writer's room. We would sit on that staircase and talk about our relationships and our love of family. In the last few years, we both shared a tragedy. Mindy's mother and my father died a few years apart, both from pancreatic cancer. I knew how much Mindy loved her mom, and she knew how much I loved my dad. When he passed, Mindy reached out to me with flowers and a card. I was in a pretty dark place, and I'll never forget her thoughtfulness in that moment. There are only a few times in your life when you know exactly how someone else is feeling. She knew the pain I was in, because she had felt it too. It is still difficult for me to talk about my dad and his passing. The nature of grief is that it can catch up with you when you least expect it and make you feel helpless. Mindy sharing about her mom inspired me to overcome that feeling of powerlessness and get more involved in pancreatic cancer research. She has been helping fight pancreatic cancer by becoming an ambassador for the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, PanCAN. Mindy's actions remind me that every little bit helps and that a way to honor my dad is to fight for others. I think now about all she has accomplished, and I feel so proud of her. She's an advocate for others. She is constantly breaking barriers for women with the stories she tells in her television and film projects. Recently, she stopped by our podcast, and I had to try hard not to tear up when she, Jenna, and myself were all reminiscing. I remember that girl at 24 years old, sitting in that circle in her brightly colored sweater. Now, seeing the amazing woman and mother she has become fills me with emotion. I am so happy for her.
The absolute best times we had on set were when all the ladies were together. It didn't happen very often, but when it did, we were delighted. The first time we got to be all together without the guys was for the season 2 episode, Boys and Girls. Remember, this is the idea that Angela and I had pitched. No wonder it involved a storyline for just the ladies. We laughed so much during those conference room scenes together. That episode brings up some interesting themes about working women, most notably the way Jan is shamed for her ambition. All Jan is trying to do in this episode is raise up the other women in the office, but for the most part, she is met with eye rolls and insults. I grew up in the Midwest in the 80s, and during that time, there was a sense that female ambition was unladylike. I noticed how women who stood up for themselves and spoke openly about their career goals were labeled as ballbusters or feminazis. Or how female public figures were physically scrutinized in ways their male counterparts were not. Jan feels all of this and more, and her anger is obvious. While rewatching the episode recently, I was also struck by something Phyllis says in response to Jan suggesting we all spend more time thinking about our careers and less time on personal stuff. Phyllis says, "I think we're all okay with the balance we've struck." This made me think of how women are also shamed for not having grand aspirations. Why so much shaming? Like our characters on the show, we all had different goals and ambitions, and they evolved and changed over the years we spent on the office. Something I've learned from working with this bunch is that we all have our own path, and the best thing women can do is help clear the way for one another in whatever way we can. For us office gals, This mostly comes in the form of showing up to support one another's endeavors, big or small. Whether it's helping to troubleshoot a work-life conflict, sending flowers on a special occasion, going to see one another perform live, tuning in to watch someone's latest project, or checking in to say, "I'm here if you need me." We try to be there for one another in any way we can.
Boys and Girls was also directed by a woman, Dinny Gordon. In all, we had 55 directors on our show, and only 6 were women. In season 1, our Hot Girl episode was directed by Amy Heckerling, who was famous for having directed Fast Times at Ridgemont High, National Lampoon's European Vacation, Look Who's Talking, and Clueless. She is a big deal, and we were excited to have her on set. We did not have another female director again until Dinny Gordon, who joined us for 2 episodes in season 2. Dinny is the coolest, and she is a trailblazer among female directors in television and film. She was one of the first women to graduate from the Yale School of Drama with an MFA in directing and has directed over 100 hours of network television as well as films and commercials. She is also the first American woman to direct a film for the domestic Chinese market, My Lucky Star, which was the number one film in China for 4 weeks. One day while we were filming Boys and Girls, we looked around and realized it was only women on set. This felt special, so we asked Dinny if we could all take a photo together. Women like Amy Heckerling and Dinny Gordon helped pave the way for other female directors on The Office. Our industry is evolving, but I remember how meaningful it was every time we heard a female voice yell, "Action!"
There were a few other women on set with us every day who were vital to our success. Our script supervisor, Veda Samarne, and our first assistant director, Kelly Cantley. If you ever wondered who made sure the fake clock above the kitchen door was set to the correct time, that was Veda. Every week, Veda created a spreadsheet and determined the approximate time of day for every scene. She would then instruct the set crew to change the clock accordingly all day long. Veda oversaw the verbal and visual continuity of each episode. She stood by the monitors next to the director and watched every moment being captured, taking meticulous notes. She made sure you said your lines correctly, that you were holding your coffee in the same hand every take, and let you know if your hair was tucked behind your ears or not. She has the quietest voice, and between takes would come up to me, saying ever so gently, "Jenna, you need to hand Jim the paper with your left hand, not your right, because that's what you did in the first 3 takes and it needs to match." If we improvised in a scene, she had to write down those lines too. I marveled at the notes she kept for every scene. We used to joke that you could never be unfaithful to Veda. If you came home and the collar of your shirt was any different from how it looked when you left, she'd notice. That always made her laugh.
Keeping the cast and crew on schedule is the job of our first assistant director and their production staff. Kelly Cantley was one of our longest-running first assistant directors. While Veda was busy tracking the fake clock on the wall, Kelly was watching the real one. She was grace under fire, and no matter what drama was happening on set, whether it be a camera issue or someone not feeling well, Kelly calmly got us through so we could accomplish what we needed to that day. She also looked out for the actors and tried to anticipate our personal needs. When I first came back to work after having my daughter, Kelly helped me schedule when I could nurse during shoot days. She also asked me how long I needed to pump and how often. She then incorporated that time into our shooting schedule. How badass is that? Because of Kelly, I was able to breastfeed my daughter for a full year. I can't even put into words how much that meant to me. Plain and simple. The women of Dunder Mifflin took care of one another. We love these ladies.
When Pam was promoted from reception to sales in season 5, Ellie Kemper was brought in as new receptionist Erin Hannon. She was originally meant to keep the position for just a few episodes, but we all fell in love with her, and Ellie was made a permanent member of the cast in season 6. Having known what an island it can be to sit at reception, I tried to visit her desk often. We had a lot to talk about. Because, as I mentioned, Ellie and I are from the same hometown. Ellie is the best, because if you say hello to her, she will talk your ear off about the weirdest and most interesting things, all the while apologizing for talking your ear off. Also, when she says something that she thinks might sound like a complaint, she whispers it like, "Don't you think it's super cold in here today?" Most of her whisper confessions are about mundane things that could very easily be said in a full voice. Sometimes she'd throw a curveball and whisper some juicy gossip. I won't reveal any here, but she would really make me giggle.
Ellie has never met a stranger, and I love that about her. She and I would sit next to each other in the hair and makeup trailer and gab away every morning. We were often partnered by NBC to do press. I was always happy when this happened because I knew there wouldn't be a dull moment all day long. This girl kept me laughing. One day we both had the same day off, and she ran errands with me and came along to pick up my daughter from preschool. I remember saying, "Ellie, you are a young gal. Isn't there something more fun for you to do on your day off than run errands with me?" She earnestly told me she was having the time of her life.
When Ellie had her first child, she was the star of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. She reached out because she had a lot of questions about pumping at work, storing breast milk, and managing a work schedule on so little sleep. She was juggling the same practical and emotional concerns of any new mom returning to work. It felt good to pass along the wisdom I'd received to the next mom in our office circle. When I was cast in my starring role on the sitcom Splitting Up Together, I texted Ellie, "First one on the call sheet!" This is something all actors dream about, but it's not often that a woman gets top billing. Since she'd gotten to this milestone before me, I knew she'd understand the pride I was feeling in that moment. She called me, and we both started screaming with joy. It was amazing. When we all got way too drunk at my bachelorette party, Ellie held my sister's hair as she vomited. Also, Ellie dressed up in a cocktail dress and pretended to be a cat on the red carpet to help support my animal rescue charity. She's just a ton of fun and reliable, too.
As you can tell, the women of the office are good at building one another up, and I would definitely add Rashida Jones to that list. I met Rashida when she played Jim's new love interest, Karen Filippelli, on season 3 of The Office. She had the unfortunate task of playing a character meant to keep Jim from Pam. This whole storyline made Rashida nervous. She was afraid people would hate her, that fans would yell at her on the street. On the show, Pam and Karen are at odds, and Angela full-on hates her when Karen creates the committee to plan parties. But in real life, nothing could be further from the truth.
I don't think it's an exaggeration to say we were a little enamored of Rashida at first. We hung on her every word. Rashida's parents are Quincy Jones and Peggy Lipton. She knows fancy people and told us fancy stories. But she is also remarkably grounded. Rashida was popular with everyone on set. She may have gotten a few of the cast and crew hooked on Sudoku. We loved her. During her run on the show, the audience couldn't help but fall in love with her, too. Some fans became quite torn on who exactly they felt Jim should end up with. Karen was supportive, witty, centered, and confident. She encouraged Jim to follow his dreams. Eventually, message boards for Team Pam and Team Karen popped up with people arguing their position. Jim eventually picks Pam and Karen leaves. We were sad to see Rashida go. Of course, she went on to star in a new show from Greg Daniels and Mike Schur, Parks and Recreation. But she has done so much more. She's the ultimate multi-hyphenate. Actor, writer, producer, director, podcaster, brand representative, activist, philanthropist. And for me, role model.
When I was growing up in Indonesia, I had a group of friends from Europe. They always looked amazing, spoke multiple languages, had eclectic taste in clothes and music, traveled extensively, and were so cultured. Of course, I wanted to be just like them. Rashida reminded me of those girls. I was and still am charmed by her. We've stayed in touch since she left the show. She is definitely one of the women I turn to when I need encouragement. She always has the best advice with the most memorable catchphrases. During one of our talks, she told me that a toxic person in my life was too, quote, emotionally expensive. And she was right. But come on, how great is the phrase, emotionally expensive? As I navigated co-parenting and joint custody, Rashida emailed me and said, quote, "You have such a great ability to neutralize and harmonize. It's fantastic. You're a survivor." That meant a lot to me. But again, neutralize and harmonize. Classic. Classic. In November 2013, Rashida and I went to Belize together as ambassadors for an ocean preservation group I work with. We were going there to see their barrier reef. It is second in size only to the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. Our goal was to bring awareness to this reef and the fragile ecosystem that depends on it for survival. I asked Rashida to partner with me, and that trip is one of my favorite travel memories. First of all, she is a world-class traveler, like a super pro. I will never forget how many little bags of self-care items she had in her carry-on. Several types of vitamins, hydrating sprays, and so many lotions. I couldn't help but stare as she applied her lotions and sprayed her face pre-takeoff. She clearly had a system and a routine. I asked her what she was doing, and she told me she has so many lotions and potions when she travels that her friends gave her that nickname. In that moment, I was very aware of how much cooler Rashida Jones is than me. My friends called me Hambone because once in high school, I stood in my friend's kitchen during a party and ate ham straight out of the refrigerator. I didn't even bother to turn on the light, get a plate, or get utensils. I just stood there, in the dark, eating ham with my bare hands. Rashida is lotions and potions because she is well-traveled and knows how to take care of herself. I am Hambone. That trip was pretty incredible. We swam with sharks, sea turtles, and thousands of fish, rode on a boat at sunset with calm waters around us, ate the best ceviche in the world, and even found a beachside bar named The Office. Rashida is truly the coolest, and I would travel with her again in a second. Rashida, hear me out. Celebrity Amazing Race?
As time went on, we added more amazing women to the mix. Amy Ryan had a recurring role. Jen Salata joined Mindy in the writer's room and also served as co-executive producer and showrunner alongside Paul Lieberstein starting in season 5. I definitely felt a shift in the way we told women's stories when Jen was a showrunner. Pam's art school storyline was under her guidance. Angela had a love triangle with Dwight and Andy. Kate was front and center in Moroccan Christmas when Michael drags Meredith to rehab, and the same for Phyllis in Crime 8 when Phyllis tries to help Dwight win back Angela. Most exciting was watching some of our female crew members step in to direct. Jen Salata and Mindy Kaling both directed episodes, as well as editor Claire Scanlon and first AD Kelly Cantley. Ellie Kemper's sister, Carrie Kemper, joined the writer's room, along with Caroline Williams, Allison Silverman, Amelie Gillette, and Nikki Schwartz-Wright. We even got a full-time female camera operator, Sarah Levy, when Matt Sohn was promoted to cinematographer. And in later seasons, actresses Amina Kaplan, Catherine Tate, and Kathy Bates joined the cast. The sausage fest was over, and things felt a lot more balanced.
Jen and I have this ongoing conversation about who and what we would take with us if there was a zombie apocalypse. I'm not sure why this topic comes up so often, but it does. Perhaps it's our love of survivalist television shows and movies, or maybe it's the fact that we wrote this book during a pandemic. Well, I would take this group of women with me. There is that famous saying, "It takes a village." The truth is, it takes a village of women. Over the course of 9 years, these women taught me to believe in myself, to trust my instincts, and they showed me what female friendship is all about. I am thankful for the time I had with each and every one of them.
I couldn't agree more. I think we should all get together and crash the patio at the Ivy and bring our own giant cake.
Chapter 7. The Men of Dunder Mifflin.
The women of Dunder Mifflin gave us life. The men gave us headaches. Ha ha, just kidding. Steve and Oscar were okay.
In all seriousness, we loved these goofballs. I don't know if Greg Daniels made kindness a prerequisite when casting men on The Office, but as we look at the men of Dunder Mifflin, you will see it comes up quite a bit.
That's what she said.
The star of a television show sets the tone on set, and you can ask any producer what happens when a difficult, insecure narcissist has the lead role. The toxicity and bad behavior trickle down and make a miserable experience for everyone. Lucky for us, we had Steve Carell as our number one. It's hard to know where to begin when sharing about Steve because my feelings of admiration and gratitude run so deep. With Steve as our leader, we all learned what was okay to make a stink about and what was not. For example, ants in our trailers. Is Steve complaining? No? Ants equals okay. Early morning call times? Wait, Steve has been here since 5 a.m. Gotcha. What about last-minute script pages? Are we stressed about that? Looks like Steve just had to memorize 3 new speeches in 15 minutes. We can handle it. Steve never complained, and I mean that. I can only recall 3 times in the 7 years we spent together on the office that Steve expressed frustration. He so rarely cracked under pressure, and no one was under more pressure than Steve. He had more lines in the script week after week than anyone. He drove most plot lines, and he was the public face of our show. That meant the bulk of the interviews, photo shoots, and promotional work fell on his shoulders as well. People often ask me, what was it like to work with Steve Carell? I think they expect me to say he was a laugh riot, always joking around and doing bits. This was not the case. Steve was very quiet. I can't tell you how many times we would be ready to start rolling, and the director would say something like, "Wait, we can't start until Steve gets here." But he would be there, usually sitting on the couch by reception, waiting patiently. It's hard to imagine you wouldn't notice that you were standing next to Steve Carell, but I guess he and Phyllis share that power of invisibility. None of my memories of Steve are of a person who was overwhelmed or stressed or worried or maniacally running lines, as I imagine I would have been if I were in his shoes. My memories of Steve are of him casually sitting on that couch, discussing his favorite pizza places or the good deal he found at the mall over the weekend, and then killing it when the director called action.
There's a joke in Hollywood that Steve is the nicest man in show business. Those of us who have had the opportunity to work with him know that it's true. Steve is incredibly kind, but he is also incredibly talented. To be on set with him felt like attending the best comedy and improv class in the world. There were several times that I lost my place in a scene because I was just watching his performance. I would forget that I had to act, too.